It's a wrong inference to endorse deterrence.
Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tymy Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, deterrence. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. And hello, Ben.
Hey. So we're going to talk about deterrence today. I wonder if it will deter anyone from listening to us anymore.
I hope not.
Yeah, me too. But before we start, though, I want to give a shout out to another dedicated listener.
Okay.
So I had my family reunion this past weekend.
Right.
And my cousin James, who I've mentioned before on the podcast.
Yes.
His wife, Joy, mentioned something to me from one of our recent episodes.
Okay.
Particularly, I think it was from our Get Tough episode where I said, like, oh, I'm cracking down in the classroom. So she was asking. Asking me how that went.
And she listens.
Yeah. And she said it's so funny because, like, I feel like I don't even need to talk to you because I've kept up with you all year. But I haven't been able to tell you what I've been up to. So anyway, we caught up. So anyway, Joy Baker, she's a high school science teacher in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So Joy, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, Joy.
Yeah, we're going to send you some Just a Minute swag. So check your mailbox for some podcast tees. It's coming up soon.
We'll get that out.
Yep. Now, back to our regularly scheduled program. So, Tymy and dear listeners, time for another What Would You Do?
Yes.
So, if you knew that you were going to get away with it, would you rob a liquor store?
No, because I have enough money to buy liquor.
Yeah.
So, I wouldn't need to rob a liquor store. But another reason is because I do not approve of stealing. It's bad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, just think about the poor clerk working at the liquor store who you're just coming in with a gun robbing and you're causing them so much anxiety and they're just there trying to get their like $11, whatever the minimum wage is now, maybe $14, $15 an hour. And now they're terrified because you're robbing the store.
Agreed. Same thing. No need.
Yeah.
I think it's wrong and I wouldn't do that to somebody.
Okay. The poor person.
Number two scenario. This might be a little bit trickier. You know you're going to get away with it, and you can steal someone's retirement account from JMU. You don't know who it is, so it's not like somebody close. $1.5 million in their retirement account. They're getting ready to retire. You could take it.
Yeah.
Would you do it?
No way. That is someone's hard earned money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm guided by my moral compass and because I am also working and putting money away in retirement, I kind of understand the gravity of stealing someone's life savings, essentially, that's supposed to help them in their sickest time. So, you know, because of that. There's no way I would do that.
Agreed. I wouldn't either. What is interesting in your remarks is that you didn't mention, well, actually I said you knew you wouldn't get caught. So anyway, never
mind. Yes, I knew I wouldn't get caught. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I still wouldn't do it.
Yeah, agreed. But listeners, if you would do these things, if you would commit these crimes because you knew you wouldn't get caught, first, way to go, a-hole.
Yes, because this is a clean podcast. We do not use those words.
Yeah, but then deterrence might work for you. So if the only reason that you're not committing crime is because you're afraid of getting punished, then you know, deterrence might be at work.
Right.
But spoiler alert, not counting, you know, those crimes that we all do, like speeding and jaywalking and shoplifting and pirating things online. But most people who are not involved in serious crime still wouldn't commit crime, even if they could get away with it, because other things besides the threat of punishment is what keeps us from stealing or killing. So the things like you mentioned, need, you know, values, empathy.
Yeah, I just think it's funny that you say, besides the crimes that we all commit, including shoplifting, like, I don't shoplift.
Well, that's true. I don't either.
I do speed, but like, jaywalk. I don't think I pirate online media anymore. But yeah, I don't shoplift.
Well, I don't either.
You're like, the things that we all do, like, no.
Okay, maybe we'll back up and take that off off the list. So shoplifting is not something that we all do. I don't shoplift either.
Accidentally. I have found something in my cart, but then I just take it back in. Because,
Well, that's interesting because in my 210 class, we talk about the difference between an accident and a crime.
Right.
So like a car crash can be an accident or a crime.
Yes.
Or taking something from the grocery store can be an accident for a crime. I'm going off on a tangent here. But you don't have mens rea, so it's not a crime. You don't have intention.
Right.
So it's an accident. It's not a crime.
Important stuff. Well, okay, let's just let's get going.
Okay, yeah. Back to deterrence, which we mentioned briefly in our Get Tough episode. So go back and listen to that one.
Yes, please.
And of course, deterrence was largely at the heart of those Get Tough policies, and it's the ideas that we make our crime laws and our punishments harsher so people won't commit crime.
Right. So let's define deterrence again for our listeners and give me some more details and our listeners about exactly what it is and where it came from.
Sure. Most broadly, deterrence is the idea that the threat of criminal justice policy and punishment will cause people to refrain from committing crime because the cost will outweigh the punishment. And deterrence as a theory of punishment goes all the way back to the birth of criminology as a discipline.
The baby is born.
Yeah, a couple of 18th century legal philosophers, Cesare Beccaria and Jeremy Bentham, who were called in all of our textbooks the fathers of criminology, outlined the early notions of deterrence.
Yes.
So first of all, the criminological assumption of deterrence is that people are rational in that they weigh the rewards and benefits of a crime before doing one. So recall from our rehabilitation episode, criminological assumption, basically the idea or the belief of a particular theory about why people commit crime. So from rehabilitation, people commit crime because of like deficits or problems. Right. So go back and see that episode.
Got lots of episodes for you to review for this one.
Absolutely. Good referrals to other episodes. So like I just said, people commit crime from a deterrence perspective because they believe the benefits will outweigh the cost.
Right.
So let me ask you, what are the benefits of crime? So what good things could you personally get from committing crime, or why might you be tempted to commit a crime?
Yeah, well, first, there might be a material need that's a benefit, right? Because like having previously worked in retail in a former life, I can tell you that theft increased around the holidays. Including like, you know, a dad who was stealing a gaming system for his child for a Christmas present. So there's that. But also maybe I just want to cut the tires of the person who pulled out in front of me and almost caused this massive accident.
Yeah, so instrumental crimes or economic crimes are kind of like goal achieving, particularly economic. Both of the scenarios we talked about at the beginning had to do with money, robbing a liquor store or stealing someone's retirement. So getting money or getting things that you want is a big benefit of crime. There's also kind of the expressive element of crime. You express emotion, anger, jealousy. You mentioned slash someone's tires, getting revenge. Yeah, so you can like be violent. You can hit someone to deal with your bad emotions about them, or you can do vandalism, destroy their property or destroy something else in frustration. There's also like perhaps a social element of that. If you think about like in high school, you know, like whoever is the biggest, toughest, meanest is kind of like the bad so you can get like reputation or street cred from it. And then there may be some like personal benefits like esteem, you know, again, being tough makes others think you're cool, but also might make yourself feel better. And then of course, like robbing a liquor store or doing a crime can be like exciting or risk taking. Yeah. Get that adrenaline pumping. I've already said that obviously I wouldn't do that, but in my two team class, when I'm talking about this, I make the joke like, oh, take it from me. When you rob a liquor store, it does get your adrenaline pumping.
Oh yeah. I always ask students if they would try heroin if it was legal.
Oh, that's a good
to
one.
To see, because I wouldn't, even if it was legal, I would never take heroin. But there are some students who say they would.
Interesting. So anyway, there are benefits. Like I guess heroin, that would kind of be the same thing. It could be like fun and exciting, and you get a fun feeling from it. But anyway, on the opposite side of coin, the pains or the costs would primarily be legal punishments, but can also include other costs or consequences of crime. Things like, you know, social cost or shame or embarrassment or losing a job. But deterrence theory assumes that the legal punishments like arrests, prison, executions are the most influential costs and the easiest way to stop people from committing crime. So if we ratchet up the cost, then that will outweigh the benefits and people won't commit crime.
Right.
And theoretically, there are three characteristics of punishment that are, you know, supposed to make it like a successful deterrent. Certainty, celerity, which nobody uses that word anymore. But basically, swiftness is a synonym for that. So certainty, swiftness, and severity.
Right.
First of all, certainty is the likelihood of experiencing a punishment conditioned upon commission of the crime. So most broadly, it's about like the chances of getting caught. If we're talking about the deterrent effect of a certain punishment, it's about the chances of actually getting that punishment right. if you commit crime. So if we're talking about the death penalty, for example, it's actually, you know, the turn effect of the death penalty. Certainty is about, you know, the chances of being executed conditioned upon committing murder. And again, we've already kind of hinted at this, but the death penalty is not a strong deterrent for homicide. Right. Research shows, because overall, again, you know, deterrence is not a super successful strategy. And even if it was, the way we practice the death penalty doesn't really conform to the way the theory says it should work.
Yes.
So like the odds of getting executed if you commit a murder is very low.
Well, let me just say that an article that I was reading this morning, let's put it here, although this is increasing, we've executed more people already this year than we have last year. So John Bloom, the director of the Cornell Death Penalty Project, says the uptick in executions does not appear to be linked to a change in public support for the death penalty or an increase in death sentences. It's rather the function of the discretion of the state governors.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's arbitrary. It is, you know, disproportionate for sure. But in terms of like the, you know, the, first of all, there's only a very small proportion of murders that you're even, you know, just like plain old run of the mill murder, you're not even eligible for the death penalty. There's to be like aggravating factors. So even though, you know, executions are I mean, there's like the gross thing that like, you know, people are rushing to execute people on death row because the drugs are expiring, so we gotta, you know, gotta kill these guys. So anyway, you know, regardless of all that, even you know, even a small proportion of murderers actually get executed.
Yeah, I just thought that highlights also that the certainty of punishment, as we've talked about before, is related to politics because it's the state governors who are just deciding to do it more.
Yes, arbitrary.
Arbitrary.
Swiftness is about the amount of time between committing the crime and receiving the punishment, and with the idea that the shorter period of time is assumed to be more deterrent. So it's almost kind of like the idea of like conditioning. You punish the crime right after it happens, and that's supposed to be more deterrent. And again, as an illustration, going back to the death penalty, the time between crime and execution is long. I think the average stays are probably like 15 plus years on death row.
Yeah, now, the guy that was just executed last night in Florida, his fine, they said, asked him for his final words, and he said, "Thank you for not letting me die in prison," like, but from his life sentence. So that was all he had to say.
Yikes! But I mean, that's interesting.
But
because
he's been on there since he's been on death row since the '90s.
Oh wow, yeah. But that kind of relates to the next point: severity.
Right.
That the harsher the punishment, the more painful, the more deterrent. And you know, objectively speaking, the death penalty is definitely the most severe punishment. But then this guy sounds like he would prefer to die rather than to stay
in prison,
stay on death row for the rest of his life. So some people have made that argument that you know it's supposed to be the most severe punishment, but
the
subjectively,
ultimate.
Some people may prefer.
Yeah.
That over
spend 20 years in prison and then see how you feel about that.
No, thank you. That's why I don't commit those shoplifts or robberies. Actually, it's not. But anyway. So at least in theory, to be successfully deterrent, a punishment should have all three of those characteristics.
Right.
And given the nature and the reality of our legal system, though, it's not super easy to increase the certainty. We already said that's, you know, one element of the problems there is that it's arbitrary. One, you know, to increase the certainty or to reduce the time the trial process takes. So if we're going to do deterrence, what's the easiest way to try to increase deterrence? Severity.
Right.
Longer sentences and harsher punishments, i.e. get tough. Severity is really the only way to practically increase deterrence, and definitely it's the simplest and most convenient. And like I've already said, there's not a lot of evidence from research that deterrence is effective, and we'll talk about more about why that's the case in detail towards the end of the episode. But specifically in looking at these three elements of deterrence, there's some research that indicates that certainty is the most important element.
Right.
And most directly that the perceived likelihood of getting caught is the most important or maybe even the only element of successful deterrence. So in studies, people who think they're likely to get caught report low likelihoods of committing crime. And like, duh, everybody who commits a crime thinks they're going to get away with it. You know, you're not going to commit a crime if you think you're going to get caught. And practically that means the police have the most potential to be deterrent. That is like when someone's committing a crime, they're not kind of contemplating like the long-term consequences of a prison sentence or execution. They're primarily proximally concerned about like getting arrested or getting caught by the police. So things like police presence and visibility have been shown to reduce crime, like hotspots policing is a successful strategy which concentrates patrol visibility in high crime areas and has lots of experimental evidence of effectiveness, but other more general police strategies like randomized patrol or rapid response, though, have been shown through research and, again, experimental research repeatedly not to be effectively deterrent. And, of course, there's not much evidence that severity or swiftness really impacts people's decision-making. And we'll come back to that idea later, that more severe and harsher punishments actually might seem to have the opposite effect of what they're supposed to.
Okay, so those are the elements of deterrence. Mm-hmm. So what about the different types of deterrence?
Yeah, I already mentioned this earlier with my little slip of the tongue, but there are two types or forms of deterrence, specific and general. Specific deterrence and general deterrence. So specific deterrence is the application of a punishment to an individual in order to deter them from repeating a crime.
Right.
So specific deterrence is supposed to deter recidivism. You actually get the punishment. It's supposed to be bad. You know, like taste and feel how bad this punishment is. You don't want to ever experience it again, so don't commit crime again. Boot camps, which were big in the 90s, are an example of like a specific deterrence policies. And I think I have a whole episode planned on this later on, so stay tuned for that. But the basic idea is that these experiences, boot camps, are supposed to be highly unpleasant. You put teens and young offenders and make them do physical exercise and, you know, clean the latrine with a toothbrush, and it's supposed to be like really bad and you don't want to do this again, and you learn discipline and you get back on the straight and narrow path.
Yeah, given my teenage years that we've already talked about in the age crime episode, if someone would have sent me to boot camp, it probably would have made me more violent, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, there is like the defiance idea that like punishment and harsh punishment can like, you know, make you resent the system and not buy into society.
Yes.
And like there's virtually no evidence that specific deterrents work. We've talked a lot about high recidivism rates, that 2/3 of prisoners are rearrested within 5 years and about half go back. In you know, like we said, there's research that indicates that harsher punishment actually increase recidivism.
Right.
And I think we might have talked about this before, but like, and we'll come back to it again towards the end of the episode, but harsher punishments tend to take away or reduce those things that keep people out of trouble. Social bonds, stakes in conformity. I know we've mentioned that before, but like family relationships, jobs, education, opportunities, and of course things like self-control and impulsivity are highly correlated, you know, with crime and recidivism, which kind of goes to the opposite of this idea of like rational calculations. And also harsher punishments expose you to more antisocial peers. You go to prison.
Good friends in prison. Meet those good friends.
Your prison pen pals.
Yes.
So specific deterrence, deter recidivism, doesn't really work. General deterrence is the application of a punishment to an individual in order to stop them from ever committing crime to begin with. So general deterrence is like setting an example of someone, and it's aimed at general crime prevention. So scared straight might be an example of this, but then also that kind of melds both forms. Because usually they're kind of like at-risk youth.
Yes.
But the idea is to take them to prison and show them how bad it is and say, you don't ever want to come here, so you better, you know, you better straighten up. So there's some elements of specific because they're already kind of like at risk or might get in trouble, but also it's like general deterrence. Look at all of these other prisoners in this bad shape.
You don't want to be there.
Yeah. And of course, I think we've mentioned this before, that scared straight actually increases recidivism, makes kids worse. That's like glorifying prisons. Yeah. Like, oh, you're not tough enough. Oh yeah, let me show you that I am.
Yep.
And then the death penalty is also supposed to be general deterrent. Look what happens when you commit homicide. Yes. You'll get executed, so don't commit homicide. And like I said before, there's some studies that show there might be some general deterrent effect, specifically in terms of certainty, the higher likelihood of getting caught, but overall little evidence that people are kind of like calculating or anticipating the long-term realities or consequences of legal punishments.
Right.
And just a quick note, I've obviously talked about deterrence in classes for decades, but I did brush up on recent research to make sure that nothing earth-shattering has changed since the last time I did a prep for deterrent research. So most of the recent research findings I referenced came from a review of the current state of deterrence research, and that's in a 2024 article in the Journal of Criminal Justice by Daniel Mears and Stafford.
Okay, so there's not a lot of research evidence about deterrence working. Why not? Why isn't it an effective crime control strategy?
Well, I mean, lots of reasons, and many we've already kind of talked about or hinted at. And some of them are kind of practical and empirical, but also, you know, many scholars kind of question the fundamental assumptions of deterrence. Obviously, you know, I highlighted this earlier, we don't really do deterrence right. we don't or we can't do what the theory says is necessary to commit crime. We can increase the severity of punishment, and we certainly have done that, make punishments harsher, increase in its length, exponentially so, and of course that's caused a lot of problems. And we went over those in the Get Tough episode. But we can't really do much about certainty. As we mentioned before, it's like also arbitrary prosecutorial discretion. We've mentioned before that only about half of crimes get reported to the police.
Yes.
So half of crimes don't get punished at all. So we don't have a great deal of certainty in our system. And the wheels of justice turn slowly. You've got trial lengths and delays and continuances. What, it took like 4 years for the shopping cart killer to go to trial?
Yeah.
So first of all, we don't really do deterrence as the theory says that we should. Number two, also kind of like focusing on punishment ignores the rewards of crime. So it's just the assumption that like punishment makes the cost outweigh the rewards, but that might not be the case, especially if we're talking about like less serious crimes. So like not murder or robbery or something, the punishment for a less serious crime actually might not outweigh the rewards. I also read something interesting about the costs of non-crime. So in some contexts, there might be costs for actually not committing crime. And the example that I read of that is like gang members. So if you're in a gang, it actually could be costly to abstain from crime.
Yes.
Another like bigger overall weakness of the theory is that it's like wholly dependent on people's perceptions of punishment. So there's a big difference between the objective conditions of punishment in the laws and what people know or what people believe about punishment.
Right.
So like how many people know the exact legal consequences of the crime that they're about to commit?
Yeah.
The criminal code is very complicated,
especially in common law countries. We have so much case law, it's like impossible, and it varies by state.
And even if you look up the Virginia criminal code, it's like
it's impossible
trying to read Latin. I couldn't tell you what the punishment option for any given crime could be off the top of my head, and I'm a criminologist with a PhD.
For child pornography. Been looking at that one recently.
So people generally don't know the law, except in, you know, certain cases where you might have an incident come up where you would like research the laws related to a given crime. And there's also the problem of like estimating how likely you are to get caught or how likely you are to get a specific punishment. And of course, people aren't very good at predicting the future.
Yes.
So overall, lawmakers and the public assume that like objective legal increases in sanctions or punishment translate into increases in perception of punishment that isn't or may not necessarily be the case.
Right.
And then finally, the assumption that people rationally weigh the costs and benefits of crime doesn't really reflect the realities
of anything.
Of why people
commit
crime.
Weigh the costs and benefits of eating that, piece of chocolate 5 minutes ago?
No, I want it. I'm going to get it.
Exactly.
You don't sit down there and like make a pros and cons list.
No, we don't do that with pretty much, well, some things we do, I guess, but not that. I mean, come on.
Yeah, maybe big decisions.
Like buying a house.
Yeah. People act impulsively a lot of times. And certainly one of the strongest, we've talked about this before, strongest personality correlates of offending is low self-control or impulsivity, which by definition means you don't think about the consequences of your actions. You act without really thinking things through. You're not sitting around making a pros and cons list about this crime that I'm about to commit. You do without thinking about the consequences.
Right. And low self-control and impulsivity doesn't need to be a static trait. Like you can have high self-control in some areas of your life and low self-control in others.
Mm-hmm.
Example, right here, chocolate.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Gaming. Gaming for me.
Yes.
And like we said in the beginning of the episode, the threat of punishment isn't really what's keeping most people from committing the crime. We talked about this before. I wouldn't rob or steal. You wouldn't rob or steal because it's wrong.
Yes.
You know, it's one of the 10 commandments, thou shalt not steal.
Yes.
And my mama taught me better.
Yes.
So in reality, like strong family attachments, commitment to your job, commitment to education, you know, what we call social bonds or stakes in conformity are more important for keeping people from committing crime.
Right.
People abstain from crime because they think it's wrong to kill, to steal, and hurt other people. And they don't want to experience public shame or disappoint their parents or flunk out of school or lose their job, much more so than like being afraid of having to wear an ankle bracelet or go to prison.
You're right.
Or whatever.
Okay, well, you got anything else?
Sure. I'll just close by kind of returning to one of the themes of our show. So media impacts on misperception is one of them, and that's not the one I'm talking about right now.
Yeah.
But another one that we've brought up a number of times is this notion that crime policy kind of often seems like intuitive and emotional, and science and research is, you know, not effective or silly, or we don't need it or something like that.
Yeah.
And of course, deterrence sounds intuitive. It sounds logical.
Like, it does.
Harsh punishment should teach people a lesson, and it should, like, you don't want to do this, so don't do this. Or if you make the punishment scary enough, people will be like too afraid to commit crime in the first place. I mean, that just kind of like has a degree of like logic or sense to it. But in reality, that isn't the case based on like decades of criminological research.
Decades, people.
As weird as that might sound. And of course, we've already covered the problems that mass incarceration and Get Tough created, and Get Tough was largely founded on this notion of deterrence.
Right.
And we also have already covered that rehabilitation works and how it works, and there's much more scientific evidence that a rehabilitative preventive strategy is more effective at preventing crime and recidivism than deterrent strategies and unendingly harsh punishments.
For sure. You know, one thing we forgot to say.
What?
That you can actually see one of the fathers of criminology on display because he's been preserved.
Yeah, mummified. I show that in my ethics class. Yeah, yeah. He's got his body. Yeah.
Jeremy Bentham. You can see him. Well, what's left of him.
Mm-hmm. Actually, all of it is left of him.
I thought some of it was deteriorating.
Well, they still have his head.
Yeah, they definitely have his head.
And actually, his real head, it was actually kind of like destroyed in the mummification process. So it looks like grotesque and scarred.
Right.
So it's not like it's deteriorated over time. They tried to preserve it, but like the process just like destroyed his head and face.
Yeah,
so they have a
whack. Someone stole it.
Three times. It's gone missing from University College London three different times.
Three times.
Yeah, so now they keep it securely locked away.
That's just like fun fact trivia at the end of that episode.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, well, I guess we'll wrap it up then with our minute to spin it, where we give our takeaway from today's episode. So Tommy, in just a minute, what's your spin?
When they installed those speed cameras on Route 33 Market Street and were giving out $100 tickets like candy, people started creeping over that interchange. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I'd be behind somebody going 10 miles per hour. And there wasn't a conversation between people like, the tickets are coming. People were getting tickets for somebody speeding beside them. Mm-hmm. It was an effective deterrent.
Yeah.
But overall, punishment is not.
but I mean, that goes back to something that we've talked about. It's not the $100 ticket.
Yes.
It's the cameras, because there's 100% certainty. Like, they have a camera system set up. They have speed radar that checks every car going by.
Right.
So there's 100% certainty that if you speed through there, you're going to get detected.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But punishment is It's not important to understand. Like, what's more important is to understand the social science behind how decisions are made.
Yep.
So Ben, what's your spin?
It's a wrong inference to endorse deterrence. And probably that should be inference, but rhymes with deterrence.
Yes.
At least in terms of criminal punishment. Like I said in our Get Tough episode, the logic behind deterrence theory always says the thing to do is to increase punishment. So if crime and recidivism goes down, deterrence is working. So keep up the harsh punishment.
Right.
And if it doesn't go down, then we need to get harsher. But there are other, more evidence-based ways to prevent crime and reduce recidivism. Just say no to Scared Straight.
We are a community-driven podcast sponsored by the Gandhi Center and produced by JMU Libraries. Check out our website linked in show notes to see how you can support our educational programming.